Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report. This is Catherine Austin Fitz, and it's my delight to bring back to the Salieri Report one of my favorite people in the world to talk to, Lucy Commissar, who is the proprietor of the Commissar Scoop. If you haven't gone there, if you haven't signed up, I can't recommend it enough. Among many other accomplishments, Lucy is one of the smartest investigative reporters on the planet when it comes to sophisticated financial fraud. She has quite a resume. She joined us in 2015 to talk about the offshore system, the offshore financial system, and tax evasion and tax fraud, among other things. And it's something she knows a great deal about. So, Lucy Commissar, welcome to the Salieri Report. I should say welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. And we go back a long time, too.
We do go back a long time. When I first met you, I just was amazed at your ability to handle complexity. You know, many, many great investigative reporters just shut down when they have to face complex finances. But you have a gift. I just told you earlier, I thought you would have, you know, you could have made millions as a bond trader. You would have been great.
Yeah. But remember, my first stories about you were how you exposed the corruption in HUD. And I wrote about that. So we have a commonality in wanting to expose corruption.
Right. So I want to go back because I really want, when we end this conversation, I really want people to understand your history and how much you have done to expose corruption. I want them to know that there are extraordinary and excellent people out there doing amazing things. And just because you don't see them on ABC doesn't mean they're there. In fact, you're never going to see them. That's not the place you find them. So I want to talk about how you ended up putting up your own website. But start us out and tell us about your trajectory of ending up reporting on corruption and fraud and then getting into financial fraud. Take us through a little bit of your history.
Okay, I started out in college in the early 60s. I got involved in the civil rights movement. I took a leave of absence from college and went to Mississippi and became editor of the Mississippi Free Press, which I was for a year. So I decided that's when I decided to be a journalist, because I thought the important thing is to help change the situation of things that are hurting people. One way to change it is to write about it. So I began to write about civil rights issues, and then I got involved in the women's movement and wrote about women's issues. I was a national vice president of NOW in 1970 to 71. Uh-huh. And from there, I got involved in writing about what was going on in other countries, in developing countries, where the corrupt people were destroying the lives of developing of people there. And I went to places like the Philippines. I was there when Marcos was overthrown. I went to Zaire. Mobutu was in charge. I went to Haiti. But one thing was so interesting in all of those places, the Philippines, Zaire, Haiti, the oppositions, and we're talking about three different continents, said, right, the dictator has looted the country and put the money in Swiss banks. And I thought, oh my God, what? Swiss banks? And I had never been reading about that in the newspapers. Of course, the newspapers never wrote about things like that. So I started looking into it and discovered the offshore system, the secret bank account, the secret company system, which is, and a lot of it, of course, is run by the big international banks. They run offshore banks because they make a lot of money. So after going to those places, I got involved in looking at the offshore system, the corrupt offshore system. And that took me into the issue of financial and corporate corruption. Because whenever there is financial and corporate corruption, they are using the offshore system. There is some way hiding their money, or they're laundering their money. One thing just led to another, and that's what led me finally to deal with the story I'm dealing with now, the William Browder Magnitsky fraud. But it also involves some other things. I discovered that Alan Stanford, who was the big Ponzi schemer after Madoff, $7 billion, and he had operated through moving money to Antigua, another offshore right. place. And
now that's the
I
one you won the Loeb Prize for your coverage.
I won the Gerald Loeb Award for that.
Yeah.
And it was page one on the Miami Herald, but none of the other media were interested in this story. They ran stories about how the poor soccer team in Antigua was no longer getting support from Alan Stanford. This was much more important than explaining the story I did, which was about how the Florida banking department
right.
had enabled Stanford to move money offshore with no regulation. I did a story about Cheney, when he ran Halliburton, was involved. They were involved together with a French company of taking bribes for Venezuela contracts. And I've documented
right.
that. Nobody went after Cheney. Too important. Again, it ran through an offshore company. The bribes were paid through an offshore company. I discovered that offshore is the place that the crooks love, because that's how they move their money. But it exists
right.
because the banks don't want to stop it. They make a lot of money from it. And the Browder story that I've been doing now also worked through offshore. He set up his operation through a Mossack Fonseca, Panama Papers, offshore companies. It was all offshore. So it's the system run by the big banks has developed a structure, a superstructure, that allows the crooks to steal from us all.
Right. And I just want to mention one of the reasons I got interested in the offshore system was, as all the money was disappearing from the U.S. government, the offshore system was exploding. And you literally, as the money was disappearing from one, the size of the assets under management in the other was rising. And it was almost as though, you know, it almost looked in some years like a direct transfer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
right.
deliberately, the authorities, the people in power in the West, have refused to look at this. It's not really that hard to stop. I once talked to, I interviewed a terrific a guy named Robert Morgenthau. He was the district attorney of Manhattan for 33 years. He just died this year. And he said, it's really easy to change
right.
this. All you have to do is say money from these jurisdictions that do not put in the real name, the real owners of the bank accounts, we will not accept that money. The U.S. already says that bad banks, meaning any banks that are in North Korea, any banks in Syria, cannot have access
right, they
to
could
the
do
U.S.
This.
Financial system. They could do the same thing with any banks such as banks in Switzerland, banks in Grand Cayman, banks in the Isle of Man. They could do the same thing because they already say, well, the bad people, terrorists, are using some of these accounts. They could say on national security grounds, we will not allow this money into the U.S. They won't do it because a lot of the people they like, the people that are connected to the government, that support the government, they are doing the same thing. And it would be so, as Morgenthau said, that's all you have to do to stop this corruption and security threats, but it won't happen.
So I don't know if you know this, but when First American went down, it was part of BCCI. Remember, it was the part of BCCI that they bought in America. Morgenthau appointed Harry Albright as the chairman as receiver for First
yeah.
American, and Harry needed ringers on the board, so he put me on the board. And I had a house, an all-glass house out in Washington, right in McLean, where the Beltway meets the river, so it was overlooking the river. And Harry sent a Brinks truck out with maybe, I don't know, 10,000 pages of documents on First American, and I spent 4 days, 18 hours a day, just reading them all, speed reading. And when it was over, I realized, you know, all of this was engineered with the approval of the big banks, the Fed, the Treasury. You know, this was not a fraud. This was, you know, an institutionalized and engineered thing. It was incredible. And Harry and Morgenthau just fought the whole time with the Department of Justice, who was trying to grab the money. And Morgenthau were trying to protect the money for the people who had been harmed, the depositors. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very fascinating situation. But you see, it was the same thing. What you see is that all of this could be fixed simply. So there was one other story I wanted to tell you. And I used to do this on the, when Enron went down, they had 700 subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands. And the Cayman Islands got tired of this being mentioned. And finally, they put out a press release that said that the Minister of Finance in the Cayman Islands would be delighted to cooperate with U.S. authorities. But as of yet, they hadn't received a request from the Department of Justice.
Of course not. They won't. So, they will not change it.
So one of the things I wanted to bring up was you also did a big investigation of Sodexo. I think that's how you pronounce their name, the big food company.
Yes. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Sodexo is one of the three worldwide food service providers. That is, if you are in, could be in a school or college or in a hospital and or in many businesses, instead mm-hmm. of, if there's a cafeteria, instead of this business or school or hospital running the cafeteria, they outsource it to Sodexo. And the contracts may say that they get paid cost plus or they get paid
right.
per meal.
Right.
When they get paid cost plus, that's when they cheated. They would say this is the cost of the meal, and they'd give all kinds of documents about their contracts, but then they would get kickbacks from the major food providers, the famous names, the one that, you know, it's not the local farmer, but famous names that package food, and they would get kickbacks. And so they were cheating. And I wrote about that because I got connected to some whistleblowers who had worked for them, and they gave me the details of the cheating. And I wrote about it. And then in New York State, the attorney general sued and got a settlement of $20 million of focusing on particular estate institutions, mostly hospitals, that had overpaid because they'd been cheated. I never saw anything about any other states going after them or anything since. And nobody goes to jail. You never go to jail. Only the little people go to jail. The big people that
right.
steal millions never go to jail. But that is what Sodexo was doing.
So,
and that was 10 years ago. And I don't know what they're doing now. But since there weren't any changes that I saw in any of the other states, I rather doubt that anything really changed. People forget.
I'm sure their competitors used it to get some contracts away from them.
Yes, that could have been. That could be true.
Yeah. So at some point, you decided to start your own website. Tell us about how you came to that decision and how it's worked out.
Oh, it's because major media, mostly, were not interested in these stories. The Sodexo story I wrote for In These Times in 2009. And then I wrote another story in 2011 for the New York Times. And that was interesting that they were willing to do it. You know why they were willing to do it? The editor at the time told me that he, as a school kid, had been one of these people that got their meals paid for. And he was always very sensitive about how the school meal system was worked, because what they tend to do is charge everybody for these meals, and then they humiliate the children whose parents cannot pay. And he told me that's why they ran. Otherwise, the Times, I think the New York Times never would have run this story, except for the editor at the time, no longer the editor of that section. But he told me that he was very sensitive to how the school meal system worked. But otherwise, I set up the website, the Commissar uh-huh. Scoop, because so much of what I was writing was not of interest to the mainstream media. So, but I still write for some of the, tends to be more on the left. 100 Reporters ran several stories about the crook bill Browder. But at least this way, if I have the story, I can put it on and people can see it. And I think more and more people understand that the real stories they need to see are not what gets printed in the mainstream media. It's what other people do. And they have to figure out what they want to look at.
So let's turn to Browder, because I know this is a story you've been covering extensively, and now Spiegel is covering it. And this is the perfect example, because at one point I decided I would go in and, you know, I kept thinking, what is this Browder story about? Because it was sort of like the, you know, the gopher in Caddyshack. It just kept popping up. And so I thought, what is this? And I started to read it, and I thought, oh, my God. Because you have, first of all, you have highly complicated finances during a period when there was enormous amounts of organized crime going on and flows going back and forth, and the intelligence agencies were deeply involved. But also the politics of Russia versus the United States right now is just mind-boggling. And so the politics are unbelievably complicated. The finances are unbelievably complicated. So tell us a little bit about Browder's story. And most importantly, what got you interested?
I was in Russia in the year 2000. And I went in Moscow to an event where Browder was speaking. And I had I don't remember how I found out about it, but he'd been involved in a company called Avisma, which was a Russian titanium company, which he, together with Kenneth Dart, built the billionaire of Dart cups. He didn't create it. His grandfather created Dart cups. And Avisma was a titanium company. Titanium is used in airplanes. They sell a lot to Boeing and other companies such as that. And the person that owned this company, and by the way, they had gotten it one of the corrupt auctions, which basically they stole patrimony of Russia. They would hold auctions, and they would be running the auctions themselves under Yeltsin, who is a very corrupt guy. And they would win the auction because they didn't allow anybody else to be in the auction.
So let me just stop you for a second. We have two great Salira reports, one called The Rape of Russia, one on Ukraine by Ann Williamson, who's done a great deal to document what's called The Rape of Russia. And this was part of The Rape of Russia, where privatizations went off at, you know, 10 cents on the dollar. My biggest fear has always been that somebody would try to do the same thing here, which we can talk about later. But it's a very significant event, and it's had a very defining impact on a huge flow of sort of dirty Russian money into the United States and into the politics between Russia and America. So I just want to tell people, for good background, go to those interviews in the archive. So, sorry, go ahead.
So Browder, with his partner, Dart, they got this company. It had been bought by, originally, the auction was by Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who's another major crook. And these auctions were always run by their own partners, their own banks or their own partners. So they would get it for, you know, cents on the, what, little bits of the ruble, not the real price. they ended up buying this from Khodorkovsky. Now, part of the deal was that they were running, there's something called transfer pricing, which goes on to a massive degree. That means you have a company and it is selling widgets. And instead of selling widgets on the market price, which means you have to pay the real taxes and you have to pay your investors the real dividends, they sell it to an in-between shell company. In this case, it was in the Isle of Man. So we have the ABC shell company, and they sell it for a fake low price. And so therefore, they pay their taxes on the fake low price, and their investors get the fake low dividends. Then the ABC fake company on the Isle of Man sells it on the world market at the real price. And these people, it was first Khodorkovsky, and then it became Dart and Browder, they get the rake off. So this is what was happening. And so when Dart and Browder bought Avisma, the titanium company, from Khodorkovsky, they said, hey, the deal is we want to continue the rake off. Otherwise, it's not interesting to us. What happened was the guy in the Isle of Man running this company, this shell company, was Peter Bond, very famous, infamous Peter Bond. And he was a crook. You know, what they say is, when you lie down with dogs, you get up with fleas. So this crook was cheating the other crooks, and he did not give them all of the money that they had skimmed from the profit. And they were really angry. So they filed a court case against him in the Isle of Man and said, you were supposed to give us this money that you skimmed. And in the end, they settled. And so he gave them, I think it was something like $8 million. Then Dard and Browder sold the company to a Russian company that used titanium in its production. It's the initials are VSMPO. And their lawyer, who happens to be a Philadelphia lawyer, went to the law firm in London that was handling Avisma and looked at the documents and said, oh my God, the documents are the law. They have the lawsuit where these guys are saying to the guy on the Isle of Man, you have cheated because you have not given us the rake off from our cheating. So he filed a RICO suit in New Jersey, and they settled. So it's confidential. You don't know, but obviously they had to pay him off. They had everything. And these documents include Browder saying to the Isle of Man guy, I'm sure we can work this out. We can figure this out. He's basically saying, yeah, we're corrupt, we're stealing, but we can figure out that you're going to pay us some of this and we'll make a settlement. So that's how I got into this. And of course, I wrote a story about it. Of course, the mainstream media was totally uninterested in this. And I got published in 100 Reporters, which is an investigative news site. So I knew then that Browder was a crook. So when this next story came up about Magnitsky, 100 Reporters, that's run by Diana Jean Shamo, who's a former New York Times financial reporter, said, okay, look into this. So I did, and I found out the crook was at it again. And he had faked this whole story about Magnitsky because he had been involved himself in, you know, a lot of fakery, a lot of corruption, tax evasion, illicit stock buys. He didn't pay his taxes in Russia. He was buying stocks of Gazprom, which is an oil and gas energy company in Russia. But you weren't allowed to buy it if you were a foreigner, because they didn't want foreigners to take over a strategic resource. You're supposed to buy it in Russia. I mean, in London, under ADRs, that means American Depository Receipts. So he set up a lot of shell companies and bought them through shell companies and pretended these were really Russians buying it. It was a total fake. And in the end, his accountant, Magnitsky, was involved in doing this fakery. And
now, Magnitsky was in Moscow or St. Petersburg? Where was Magnitsky?
It was in Browder was in Moscow. His shell companies were listed elsewhere, but he was in Moscow, and it was all crooked. And they went after him, and there were court cases, and he finally was not allowed, not given a visa, because to have a visa to a country, you're supposed to at least be not a crook. By then, they knew he was a crook. They didn't give him a visa. They arrested his accountant, Magnitsky, who had been doing all the tax evasion stuff, and he died in prison because of he didn't get proper medical treatment for his illness. Browder immediately, who never said anything while this guy was in prison for almost a year, never said a word about my poor accountant, he's in prison and he's being mistreated. Later, he would say he was beaten every day, but somehow during the whole year, he never said he was beaten every day. And he invented a story that the Russians had killed this guy because he had blown the whistle on a corruption scheme. And of course, the corruption scheme happened after the whole story of the investigation into Browder's tax evasion. And the guy had never blown the whistle on anything. It was all fake. But the American media just repeated what Browder said. Never asked for any evidence. Never, ever, ever. This, you know, this goes back to the Tonkin Gulf resolution. Remember the fake attack on an American warship in the Tonkin Gulf that allowed Lyndon Johnson to escalate the war in Vietnam? How about weapons of mass destruction that allowed the U.S. to invade Iraq? It's all fakery. And the media knows the history of American fakery and has never asked for any evidence. The whole story is fraud, is, you know, it's fraudulent. And it's only now, and I have written about this for the last couple of years, it's only now, since November, that Der Spiegel, the major news magazine in Germany, has written the same story. And the reporter told me in an email that he'd read my stories. So I was really glad if I contributed to that. It's a major, major breakthrough. And the Western, the American, and the UK media has totally ignored this story.
So my impression, and I don't understand it, you can explain it to us, is that Browder's sort of story and lobbying was able to get an act passed, named after the accountant, that has given the U.S. tools to use in a variety of international situations that they might want for other reasons.
Browder, so the Russians had a lot of evidence about his massive tax evasion and illicit stock buys. It now the numbers go up to $100 million. So he was buying Gazprom, which is their major oil and gas company, pretending he was buying it through shell companies in Russia when you weren't allowed to buy it unless you were a Russian citizen. But he set up these fake shell companies, and he didn't pay taxes because he said he had set up some shell companies in Kalmykia, a region that was trying to help disabled people, including Afghanistan war victims, and said if you had 50% of your employees disabled, you could get a massive tax cut. So he made up that he hired all these people. And in fact, he didn't hire any of them. It was all a fake. And he provided the documents of these people in his tax claims. But then the investigators found out, he said they were stock analysts. And they said, well, this guy's a gardener. He's working here. They were all manual workers. The guy's a major crook. And so the Russians said, you're a major crook. And we don't accept, we're going after you for your tax evasion. And as far as the Americans were concerned, they just wanted, for their own reasons, I'm talking about the government and a lot of the media, just attack Russia. They didn't care. This guy was a useful idiot. Or maybe he was more than a useful idiot. I don't know who's behind him. But they didn't really care. And so this story became a major story. And the Magnitsky Act was this. Browder needed to build a wall against the Russians going after him for his tax evasion and his illicit stock buys. Because normally, countries cooperate with each other if there's a crook involved. And they provide information, and if necessary, they even provide extradition. He needed to prevent that. How could he prevent that? He could prevent that by building a story that the whole Magnitsky story was an attack on him by the Russians, and it was unjustified, and they had actually murdered Magnitsky, and everything said was untrue. The purpose is how to prevent the Americans from cooperating with the Russians on a case which involves a real crook like Browder. And that's why he did it. Why did the Americans do it? In the Russophobic American policy, they needed another story. They needed, as many as they could get. They needed more stories that were, oh, the Russians are really terrible people. This was really convenient. It worked out on both sides. So they passed a law in 2012, which included all of Browder's lies, like this guy was a whistleblower and that he had been beaten to death. That's really interesting. They also include a section on Khodorkovsky, which had nothing to do with any of this, except he was the guy also involved in the Avisma story. So we really know it's much more than just Browder, because why is Khodorkovsky suddenly in there? Well, we find out that Khodorkovsky spent about $500,000 lobbying for this law. So that's why he's in it, because you buy the Congress, right? You lobby for a law and you get your name into the legislation. So that's what the law is. And basically what's happened with the Der Spiegel article, it shows that the law is based on fakery. There's no truth in there. There's no evidence. But of course, the media and the government, you know, is not going to.
So two things. What I find is in situations like this, because I don't know much about this other than what I've read on yours and Der Spiegel's website, but, you know, guys like this can't do what he does without massive air cover. In other words, the banks and the intelligence agencies have to be allowing it to happen. They have to be taking advantage of it or supporting him or sponsoring him or happy to see him doing it. In other words, it can't. You know, I was an assistant secretary and a very prominent business person. I was very wealthy. I had a very good reputation. And they were able to break the law and do just untold amazing things to me. So when the Department of Justice, you know, wants to, they're above the law as a practical matter. And so
let me tell you that why what you're saying is true. And I haven't written about this because so far I haven't gotten somebody to pay for this story, but I'm going to tell you anyway.
So, okay.
There's a guy named Ken Delanian, and he is a national security reporter for MSNBC in Washington, and he's on TV all the time. He did a story, and I didn't know about it because he was working on this a year before my story was printed. My first story on the Browder-Magnitsky hoax was in October of 2017. Now, go back a year and a half to May of 2016. He had the story of Browder's fakery, the whole hoax, everything that Browder said was wrong. And he was going to run this as a big MSNBC story. And he was talking to Browder via email and saying, look, I know this and this and this, and I want to talk to you about X. And he was asking all kinds of questions, and he obviously knew a lot. And they're going back and forth on email. And then he finally says, because Browder is not cooperating, Browder is putting out a lot of stuff which he knows, which Delanian knows is a lie. And he says, well, we're going to go with this tomorrow. What happens? Browder gets his lawyers to send a legal threat to MSNBC. And this is in May, and MSNBC caves. And the investigative editor is the same one that killed the Weinstein story, the Harvey Weinstein story.
Oh, you're kidding.
So what is more interesting about that is, on the emails, LinkedIn is Robert Otto, who is in INR, it's the State Department area looks into what's going on in various parts of the world, and they provide information to the parts of the State Department that are more in policy. He was their Russia expert in INR, in their research, intelligence and research is what it is. He is being copied all of Browder's emails to Delanian. He is seeing everything. And he is also sending emails to his boss. And he is commenting on what's going on. And he is saying he doesn't really believe Browder on a lot of this stuff. Browder is embellishing. And he's pointing out things where Browder is lying. The State Department knows that Browder is lying. And how do I know this? Robert Otto's emails were hacked. And this was written about in Foreign Policy magazine.
Now, was this the WikiLeaks hack?
It was not WikiLeaks. No? It was Robert Otto, the State Department guy, And right. It was written about in Foreign Policy Foreign Policy Magazine is basically, you know, an establishment publication. They said the State Department has been hacked. They didn't say who, and they didn't say what it was about. They didn't say it was Robert Hood. They didn't say it was about Browder. Nothing. But it got out, and the people that hacked it made it available. And in the story that I wrote, of course, I put in the link. And I saw all of the documents where the State Department knows that Browder is a fake. Robert Otto knows that Browder is a fake. He's a very convenient fake. They all know the story is a fake. And the other thing that's interesting, so this is in May of 2016 when the story that Kendallanian wanted to do was killed. What happens 1 month later? In June 2016, that is the Trump Tower meeting. That is where the Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya comes to talk to Trump Jr. about the fakery of Browder and the Magnitsky story and opposing the Magnitsky Act. And that's what she's talking to him about. What do you think would have happened if 1 month before NBC had run this story saying, it's all a fake, Browder's a fake, the Magnitsky Act is based on fakery? What do you think would have happened? Maybe there would have been no meeting. Maybe it would not have been necessary. This is one of the major parts of the Mueller report. The Mueller report says there are six key important things that we are dealing with. One of the six is the Trump Tower meeting. There would have probably been no Trump Tower meeting, or would it have been totally different? It would have been a discussion of Ken Delanian's expose, or maybe a lawyer would have said, look, we don't even have to do this now. It's now out in the print. That changes everything. Now, what's interesting, so that was in June of 2016. My story comes out in October, and I didn't know that he had been doing this. So Ken Delanian tweets to his followers, here's a story you really need to read. It's my story. He tells everybody to read my October 2017 story in 100 Reporters, because it's the truth that MSNBC would not allow to be put on the air. And so much changes because of that. So here we see, you know, the corrupt media. And what is the result of the corrupt media? And what, you know, one thing leads to another. And still, the American media will not write the truth about this. And it's only now that Der Spiegel has written the story that who knows whether anything will come out, but at least it's now in the mainstream media. So if people go to my website, The Commissar Scoop, I have that story. I have the links to the Der Spiegel story in German and English, and people can follow it.
So I can't remember the exact dates, but there was a meeting that Trump had with Putin, and there was massive effort by what I call the shriekometer to stop him from meeting with Putin. But after the meeting, when he came out and they made a joint press conference, and Trump said something, I thought it was about this act or this situation.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Yes, yes, yes.
What was that?
Oh, absolutely.
What happened? Can you explain? I knew something had happened, but I never knew enough about Browder to know what had happened.
Well, Trump knew that the story was a fake. He tried to get, but you know, we know that. Putin knew it was a fake. But the thing with Trump is he's really manipulated by a lot of people. And
right.
So that happened, but his people were not going to allow him to look into this story. And even
right.
though he, on some foreign policy things, is much better than the Democrats have been in recent years, or the normal Republicans. And for some reason, which I cannot figure out, he doesn't seem to want to have forever wars. he's not been allowed to pursue that policy. And so part of it is, how do you get better relations with the Russians, which he seems to want to do? And this is one of the impediments, because it's basically saying, you people did this, and we are going to sanction you. And now, of course, what Browder is doing is using the Magnitsky name to get so-called Magnitsky laws around Europe. Now, there's no reason, he says they're human rights laws. There's no reason to call them Magnitsky laws. The whole purpose is, his purpose is to prevent the Russians, it's a big PR scheme, do not let the Russians go after me for my $100 million tax evasion. So we're going to call every possible human rights law a Magnitsky Act. There is no reason for that, because Magnitsky was never a human rights person. He was a tax accountant organizing tax evasion. How can you name a human rights law against a guy who, where the evidence is he's a tax evasion accountant? That's what he did.
Right.
But if you do think that the American media is going to look at it, or anybody else that, you know, It's too difficult to look at these.
So recently we had a reporter who was filmed at NBC News complaining about the fact that her story on Epstein had been suppressed for several years. And Project Veritas got a hold of the video. Somebody leaked it to them and they made it public. I don't know if you saw that, you know, that leaked video.
I thought there was somebody on ABC that had said that. I didn't know
it was ABC. You know, I pay no attention to the media, so I'm very bad at these things. But here's what's interesting. I had dinner many years ago with a woman who had been the personal assistant to Michael Eisberg when he ran Disney. So he was the chairman of Disney. She was his personal assistant. And every afternoon, she brought in the proposed headlines for ABC that evening, and he would edit it, including deleting some. And so, you know, those headlines were reviewed and approved at the very top of the food chain. And of course, they're saying that the president of ABC must have suppressed it. I would say no. I'm assuming from what I heard, it was the chairman of Disney. But that's the extent to which the U.S. news, you know, you have investment interests who are managing the news for a variety of their investment interests or the, you know, the issues that they have. She said one of the reasons he would delete things is he had issues in front of Congress. He didn't want to upset anybody or irritate anybody when he was trying to focus on getting his issues approved.
Yeah. Yeah, the American media is basically corrupt. Let's just leave it at that. They're basically corrupt. And if you want to get news, you have to go way, way down to places like your site, my site, other sites who are not being paid off.
Right, exactly.
And where you get evidence also, where you get evidence, because basically at the moment, the Russian story has made the media so Russophobic. You really, I read the Times online. I mostly ignore any of the stories on Russia because when I start to read them, I see in two sentences a lie. And I say, oh my God, I can't read the rest of this. They basically lie. Well,
you know what the greatest confusion for me is? If you look at, I just finished publishing a big report called The State of Our Currencies. And we've known for decades that if we want to preserve the dollar as reserve currency, the one thing we have to make sure of is that the Russians and Chinese don't get together, and then the Germans and the Russians don't get together. But we seem hell-bent on doing exactly that. And it's kind of baffling to me. It's almost as though there's a concerted effort by Congress and the media to make sure we lose the reserve currency status.
I think part of the problem of the ideology is it makes you stupid, or it makes you unable to do things that you know are smart, because there are so many stupid people out there, you're going to be attacked. I went to a meeting at the Council on Foreign Relations just yesterday, and the speaker was a guy named Tom Graham, who's connected to the Kissinger associates, but he's a Russian expert, and he was really surprising. He was talking about how the U.S. and the Russians really need to get together, and this kind of, you know, hostility, the blocking, is really not good because there are a lot of interests, there are disarmament interests, they're dealing with terrorism. There are real interests that they have. And his whole argument was, considering the period we are in, it's what you want to hear. He started the whole thing with about two or three paragraphs of speaking about how terrible Putin was, how terrible Russia is. It's almost as if you are not allowed to say, let's get together and do something that makes sense in foreign policy without putting up in front, oh my God, I'm not a Putin acolyte. I want to tell you how much I hate Putin, on and on and on. Three sentences, I hate Putin. Now I can make some sense and say something. I can't, it was so sad.
It's like a loyalty oath.
Yes, it was. It was really, really sad. And then I was able to ask a question, which I will put on my website because they, you know, all of these are videoed if they're online. If they're not considered secretive, you know,
uh-huh.
If it's open, but I will put it. So I asked them about, I told them about the Spiegel story, and they had come to the conclusion that Browder is a fraudster and the whole story about Magnitsky is a fabrication. And I gave some specifics and said, well, I really think I believe the Browder story. And he gave me no evidence. So I said, can I send you their article where they have a lot of evidence? And I suspect he's not going to respond to me. I will put this on my website because you are not, certain things you are not allowed to do, and you are not allowed to challenge certain things. At the moment, you're not allowed to challenge Putin's a bad guy. You're not allowed to challenge Browder is a hero. And Magnitsky, his tax evasion accountant, is also a hero. You're not allowed to say that, because if you say that, they're not going to listen to anything else. So I think Tom Graham, who seemed to be a decent guy, is terrified, as many of these people are now, of being tagged the wrong way. And he has to say these lies, which is so, so sad that even the quasi-decent people have to say these lies. I will send you this the video.
We know
when it comes out.
I'm glad to hear that he's talking about the interest, because we have big nuclear armament, you know, disarmament and nuclear arms issues coming up in 2020, and we can't afford to not deal effectively with them. You know, it'll be pretty frightening if we don't.
He was talking about the start. He was talking about,
right.
I mean, he made a lot of sense, and he said as much as he could. But, you know, I almost felt sorry for him having to put in this first part. But that's really where we are, that to be acceptable, you have to sort of bow and say, but I really believe in X, Y, Z. And even if I'm saying something that you may not agree with, I'm somehow, you know, in your group. We are in a terrible state. Now, I'm still waiting for media to follow on this Der Spiegel story. This is very important that they did this, I was very proud when the reporter, Benjamin Bitters, told me that he had read my stories. So
mm-hmm.
I hope I helped in
well,
this.
Well, and I think, I'm sure you did, because, you know, these things compound. When you take a situation that this is this complex, to have somebody of your ability with financial complexity go through it, read it, study it, document it, write it up, describe it, you know, it makes it so much easier for the next guy. And I'll never forget one reporter calling me when I had put up a huge amount of research on Pug Whitaker. And a lot of it was just sort of laying out all the SEC documents, digging them out, getting them up, and showing you, you know, all the different roles and what he was involved in, et cetera. And he called me and he said, you know, I got up this morning, this is after Enron had gone down, and he said, I decided I'm going to out Pug Whitaker. And I said, you know, it's going to take me a year because I'm going to have to dig out all these SEC documents. It's really complicated. And then I got online and realized, no, I can do it in a week because you've done all the hard work. So every person who does a piece makes it easier for the next guy.
Yeah, that is true. But they don't have the guts to do it because we are in a McCarthy land where people have no courage. I mean, you know, we need people that will open this up on the mainstream, because people like me who put this it's not enough.
I disagree with you, Lucy.
You do.
I think we need everybody to stop reading corporate media, which is useless.
Yes.
and signing up to the Commissar Scoop and reading you and supporting you and quoting you and saying, well, if Lucy Commissar says it, it must be true. You know,
and here's the document.
And the audience needs to shift. The audience needs to shift to the people who are trying to protect them. I mean, the reality is when I became an investment advisor, I no longer do individual investment advisory, but while I was doing it, I had a lot of people come to me because they had gotten burnt in Stanford or in, is it Stanford or Sanford?
Stanford.
Stanford. So they'd gotten burnt. One of them had gotten burnt in Stanford. Several have gotten burnt in Madoff. And you look at the harm that is done to people. You know, you say Stanford, you know, stole $7 billion. But when you break that down into the families that now can't afford college, or the kids have to take out student loans, or the people who lose their homes, or the people who even lose their life, they have heart attacks and die because of the stress. So if you look at the human harm that these guys do, you know, it's not $7 billion. It's hundreds, if not thousands, of lives that are very seriously harmed or destroyed. It's horrible.
Yeah, right. It's so important. But what I meant to say is, there was Edward R. Murrow, and he was the guy that many credit with taking down McCarthy in the public sphere. You know, McCarthy had been attacked in the Army McCarthy hearings. You know, the famous statement, "Do you have no shame?" But the Edward R. Murrow report on the Army McCarthy hearings on CBS was really important. The TV would not do something like that today. They're in the pocket of people that run the system. And that is the tragedy. We don't have an Edward R. Murrow.
Right. It's interesting. Dr. Farrell just did a new book on McCarthy, and it turns out to be more complicated than I thought. So I'm developing a different view on McCarthy, but you're right. Murrow was an amazing reporter. And I agree with you. I think there has been 20, 30, 40 years ago, I think there's been a steady debasement. And part of it is, if you look at who's bought up the media industry, it's become very centralized, very consolidated. And it's really run as a for-profit business to advantage the investors who, like my story about the chairman of Disney, you know, they have other interests, and the news media is representing their interests, not the interests, you know. And unfortunately, it's the same with Congress. Everybody, that's why I wrote the Dylan Reed book, to show you that, you know, the Congress is doing something to make the stock go up, and then that generates capital gains, which pays the lobbyist, who then, you know, kicks back contributions to, to the politicians, and around, you know, it's a spiral, and around you go. Well, Lucy, tell everybody how to find you, how to follow you, how to keep up with you. I always love it when you go to the Council on Foreign Relations and ask your questions.
That will go up in a day or so, as soon as they put up their video, and I will write about that, and I will show the video. The website is thecommissarscoop.com, thekomissarscoop.com, and on Twitter, there's a really active Twitter conversation, which is @LucyCommissar, and what's very interesting is many of these people on Twitter, and by now it's a few thousand, which is, you know, it's not like the it's not the Kardashian numbers, but very serious people. This is real citizen journalism. A lot of these people are doing their own investigating, and very often I get emails and links, and there are Twitter feeds saying, I found this, and look at this, and putting in a link on that. So this is really citizen journalism. People are cooperating in getting more information on the brow to corruption and all the aspects of it, and including what the governments do and are not doing. So to me, that is very exciting, because people, as in the mainstream media, everybody wants to get a scoop and they don't want to tell anybody anything else. This is on the Twitter feed, everybody is cooperating and giving people links
right.
to things and information that they would like to have. So it's even a very new way of doing journalism where I am learning a lot in what I write because
yes.
somebody sent me a link I didn't know about.
So I have to tell you, when I decided, I didn't realize you were on Twitter, so now I'm following you. I have to tell you the story of how I discovered Twitter, because I've been so negative on social media. I wanted nothing to do with Facebook, nothing to do with Google. Well, then Jamie Dimon, after the bailouts, so maybe it was 2012. I don't know. At some young person in charge of social media, JP Morgan Chase, decided that Jamie Dimon should do a Twitter chat. And he gets Jamie Dimon. Jamie Dimon shows up for this Twitter chat, and the whole independent financial media was waiting for him. All of them. They were all ready. They had their tweets prepared. Jamie Dimon didn't have a chance. After 24 minutes, they walked off. They just shut it down and walked off. It was supposed to be an hour. And if you read, I think it was like 120 tweets. If you read them, it is the funniest thing you have ever read, because they nailed him. They just nailed him, and he couldn't respond because they had facts, figures, you know, and a lot of smart, really smart, smart people. It was hysterical, and I said, you know, I can do Twitter.
This becomes an alternative media. So what would be interesting to me now is for somebody to pull together a lot of this stuff and make even a website of it, so it becomes, so you don't have to go through dozens and dozens of tweets,
right.
have it organized so it becomes articles. So you have people
right.
dealing with him on one subject and another thing, they're dealing with him on another subject. That would, to me, be very interesting
right.
to do. So we really become, you know, the media, we both agree, is basically corrupt. So we need an alternative media. And this is not just having some alternative website, but it's having all of these people cooperating who often know a
right.
lot more just because of their access to information than any one particular alternative website. So that, to me,
right.
that would be very interesting, because I have found the same things as you have found, and I have to go through it every day one at a time. I'd sort of love a way for it to be collected.
Right. That's true. Well, so one other thing I wanted to mention, because in April, I'm going to see the musical Tina, and you wrote a review of it. So I just wanted to ask you, it sounds to me like I'm really looking forward to it, but you liked it, right?
I liked it for what it was. It's
right.
I tend to like political plays, but what's interesting about it, it's the music, but it's the true story of a woman who had a very abusive husband. And she
right.
was able to overthrow this guy. He was really nasty. He beat her. In the end, she was able to overthrow him. She became a world success. And with the help of her manager, who was a woman, she became a great success. And so she survived and she overcame. And this is very nice to hear.
What she accomplished was remarkable.
Yeah.
She's just a remarkable human being. So, okay. Well, speaking of remarkable human beings, Lucy, you are a remarkable human being. You're so dedicated to the truth, and you just stay totally directed and focused on producing the truth, even if that means you have to create your own media channel. That's what you've done. And, you know, your work is terrific. And if there's anything I can do to support you, I want to do it. And I just encourage everybody to discover you, to go to Commissar Scoop, and just enjoy the fact that there are some of the brightest, most capable people in the world are doing plenty and have been doing plenty for, you know, every year, certainly since you got out of college. God knows what you did before then.
Before before I got out of college, I went to Mississippi, and that was what I was doing in college.
Okay, well, Lucy Commissar, you're great. We thank you so much for joining us on the Salieri Report. You have a great day, okay?
Thank you. It was my pleasure, as always.
Bye.
Bye.